Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer, WNYC, and Kurt Eichenwald's story about teenagers lured into the world of online pornography and his rescue of one such young man made the front page of the New York Times, maybe you remember, resulted in criminal prosecutions and led to his testimony before Congress, a visit to Oprah, and to this show, where a caller asked whether he was too close to the story. His reply?
I am not balanced in terms of dealing with these people because I have been in this world, I have seen this world, and I understand how fully horrific it is.
Whether Kurt Eichenwald was too close to this story is a question that continues to reverberate. Earlier this year, news that he had paid his main source $2,000 before deciding to report the story prompted a column by the Times public editor, and now the news that more money was involved has raised even more questions. He spoke recently with NPR media reporter David Folkenflik, and they both join me now. Welcome back, Kurt Eichenwald, and welcome, David Folkenflik.
Good to join you.
Glad to be here.
Kurt, could you just, for our listeners who may not be familiar with it, recap briefly the story of your source, Justin Berry?
Justin Berry was a young man who, at the age of 13, got a webcam as a promotional item for signing up to an internet service. And shortly after he went online and loaded his image on the internet, he was approached by internet predators. And after a number of weeks, he was offered money if he would take off his shirt, and things went downhill from there. And very quickly, he was aided in establishing a for-pay website where people would give him money to strip naked and masturbate on camera. And over the years, he did this. Over 5 years, he did this and progressively deteriorated both emotionally in his health and as a human being. And at the age of 18, I discovered him. I did not know what he was or who he was. Entered into an effort to try and figure who this person was. Ultimately rescued him, and after that rescue, it became clear to me that he was willing to flip on his industry, and at that point he became a news source.
And what does that mean, that you rescued him?
Justin was in the middle of a criminal conspiracy. He was a drug addict. He was suicidal. He was about to be subjected to a horrific series of exploitations that I was told about. And my wife and I, who were working on this together in consultation with our minister in June of 2005, decided that we had to intervene. And we intervened to stop the horrific exploitation.
And why did you pay him any money? It sounds like he had a thriving business, seedy though it was and exploitative though it was.
Well, this, we have to go back to the concept of the money, because this has been misreported so many times that now, you know, fantasy has become reality. As I said on your program when I was first on it in January of 2006, this had nothing to do with journalism in June of 2005. This was all about a rescue attempt. And the reality of that world was that the only people that this was about money. This was about trying to get money out of people. And they hit me up for money and hit me up for money. And when I refused, the conversation started dwindling. And my wife and I talked about it. And, you know, we are well off. And we invest a lot of money in trying to help people. And we decided that if this really was a child in danger, that it was worth it to us to keep the conversation going. And so we used our money. We consulted our minister about the idea, and he agreed. We used our money to keep the conversation going, to make us seem like we were very credible people and to gather information. And in the end, when we decided we had to intervene and I urged Justin to meet with me, you know, I'm sure that played a very big role in his decision
right.
to do so.
All right. So NPR's David Folkenflik, why did you decide to report the story of Kurt's story as a media issue?
Well, for those of your listeners who read the New York Times with any regularity, you know, Kurt Eichenwald is something of a star in the world of business reporting and investigative reporting. He's one of the Times' lead figures in that. If you read about Arthur Andersen, the collapse of that, or particularly Enron or Prudential, you'd know his byline and know his work. It's a very impressive catalog. Last year and earlier this year, things started to be written by someone we'll talk about a bit later in the show, I'm sure, a woman named Debbie Nathan, but also subsequently others, that cast some of Eichenwald's actions in a negative light. And he reacted very viscerally in two ways, one of which ways is he demanded retractions and he said he would sue, which is an interesting thing for a journalist to do to someone else who writes for a living. It seems like a doctor threatening a malpractice suit. And the second thing that he said earlier this year was he said, you know, all these media critics are weighing in and blasting me for things that I did. He's a little modest in talking about what he did for Justin Barry. He also made sure that the young man quit drugs. He also got him to relatives outside Dallas for safe shelter. He also got him a series of counseling sessions.
Kurt did all this stuff.
Kurt Eichenwald
did
all those things.
So he really did rescue him.
But hold on. But you need to make a distinction here. Except for the getting him off drugs, everything else I did for him, I did as a reporter, after a source
understood, but let me walk through some of this. Nonetheless, what he did was vital to this young man sort of grounding himself and trying to, seems very much, to forge a new life and a new identity. And this was, as Eichenwald now says, this was after he had decided in consultation with editors in New York to pursue this as a story. But he had done all these things earlier this year. He said, you know, all these media critics are weighing in and they haven't picked up the phone to call me. They haven't talked to me about this. They haven't talked to the other key players involved. They haven't talked to prosecutors in Michigan. They haven't talked to the young man's lawyer. They haven't done other things. And I thought, you know, it doesn't take a lot of brilliance. Say, I can pick up the phone. I can call him. I can do that. And I did. And it took months of intense conversations with Kurt to get him comfortable with the idea of talking about the toll that this story has taken on him and his family.
And Kurt, you told David that you have epilepsy. How does that fit into this story?
Well, the world knows I have epilepsy. I mean, I wrote about it in 1987 in the New York Times Magazine. It is something that I have dealt with for 28 years. I have had thousands of seizures in that time. What I did not openly disclose, if you read it very carefully, it's hinted at, but what I did not openly disclose in that magazine article is that I have had so many seizures over the years that I suffer from another symptom. It's a very serious symptom of memory deficits. And so in my professional life, I know to always compensate. I know that I have to take notes of everything. I know that I have to keep records of everything. Things that I read, I tend to remember. Things that I do can disappear. And so when I converted a personal experience, which it was in June of 2005, where I was taking no notes, into a professional experience, it didn't occur to me, and it should have, it didn't occur to me that that was dangerous. And the result was that there were things that happened in June of 2005 that I don't remember to this day.
Mm-hmm.
Among them, I mean, my favorite thing I like to point out, probably the most important witness on my behalf about what was happening is my minister, who I spoke to repeatedly. I have no memory of ever talking to him at all about it in June of 2005, but everyone assures me that I did.
In fact, we have a clip of your minister from David Folkenflik's NPR piece. Here he is on the toll this has taken on you.
It really created for him a spiritual and faith crisis. You know, it was the real idea, how can human beings do this to each other? How can God allow this to happen in the world? it really has been and continues to be for Kurt a dark night of the soul.
So, David, what's the issue here? I mean, if all that Kurt did was pay this kid, who it sounds like he rescued on many, many levels, for access to keep the conversation going so that a larger good could be done, I don't see much journalistic ethical challenge there. But it goes beyond that?
Well, you know, this is as complicated and as tangled a media story as I've ever addressed in the 7 years I've had this beat. Kurt Eichenwald, with the consultation of his wife and minister, approached this young man not as a reporter, and he sought to save him. And that's a very intense and personal action to save someone. He paid money not for access journalistically, but just for access to keep a conversation mm-hmm. going and to pull him away. He then, in July, takes him, you know, basically flies him to Texas with the Times and gets him this array, starts to get him on this array of benefits. It serves as a conduit to a lawyer, serves to drive him for counseling and health care that he desperately needed. And as you say, this seems to be a larger good. In addition, he then sets on a course to tell a story about the dangers that teenagers have in being lured through their own portal, through the internet, in their own bedrooms, into this world of degradation. And in a sense, a larger journalistic mission is being served there. Eichenwald has made it clear that he feels that he didn't intend from the outset to focus as squarely on Justin Berry as he ended up doing. But if you listen to him and his wife and his minister, and if you think about where he was at the time, he was completely emotionally invested in the well-being of this young man. That is a very difficult position for a journalist to be in, and it means that your judgments are not simply being made journalistically, but they're also being made on a very human and personal level.
You mentioned before. Go ahead, Kurt.
Well, the one thing I'd like to interject there is I don't think it is humanly possible to write about the exploitation of children if you have in fact gotten yourself inside the network and if you have in fact found one of the children who has been abused and exploited, who is suffering from malnutrition, who has whip scars on his back, who is infected, who is dying, who's a drug addict. And to come away from that saying, well, you know, let's stay completely emotionally detached from the situation I'm in, it's impossible. But what I would say, I want to go back to, is the big picture here. Everybody talks about all of the challenges I had in doing the journalism. Everybody talks about how unusual this is. But then you go to the end product, and the end product is a news story. And that news story, despite the endless series of assaults on how I did what I did, the news story stands. The news story stands in every single way. And what that means is, despite all the challenges, despite the unprecedented ethical conundrums that were presented in this case, almost all of which were disclosed, by the way, despite all of these issues, I managed to navigate this very complicated situation and protect the journalism. And at some level, you know, journalistic ethics is about, is the journalism fair?
So
is it right? Is it accurate? And this was.
The story got out. People who were predators have been subject to criminal prosecution as a result. And yet, NPR's David Folkenflik, I want to ask you, where that other person who you mentioned earlier, Debbie Nathan, comes in. She's the reporter who first debunked the McMartin daycare case years ago and appeared in the movie Capturing the Freedmen. She's a big critic of how we as a society handle child pornography and child sexual abuse cases. She thinks there's hysteria. She thinks there's overblown interpretations of things that are not real. What was her objection to Kurt's reporting?
Well, I think initially her desire was to use it as a springboard to her own argument. She has written before and used his case in Salon to argue that protection should be expanded for journalists and researchers.
On the website salon.com.
Yes, that's, I believe, in August of 2006, that protection should be expanded. He had written a follow-up story, a second story, actually, talking about near-nude sites that were still very still essentially child pornography. And she had said that obviously he would have had to view images in order to be able to write the descriptions he did. Actually, he's been very clear all along. He said that's absolutely untrue. He had viewed a couple, he had reported them to authorities, and he had relied on the descriptions by pedophiles in text chat rooms about this. But that she was using the case initially as a way of trying to argue that you should rip open and expand the universe of people allowed to obtain and possess child pornography, which of course itself is a federal offense. Yeah.
And I just to expand that a little bit. I mean, Debbie never asked me a single question before she went into Ceylon and specifically accused me of committing hundreds of felonies. She accused me of lying. She said that I admitted to her that a law I cited in my story did not exist, which itself was, that statement was untrue. And I learned about all of this after the Ceylon story was posted. I had no idea that she was doing this. And I felt very, very used. Here's a woman who's accusing me of crimes for the purpose of saying we should partially legalize child pornography. Now, this is an argument, this whole concept of journalists having access. This is an argument that during my reporting I saw being advanced over and over again in the pedophile chat sites. And the reason they want it done is not about giving journalists the ability to challenge the government. It's about turning child porn from what's known as a per se violation, meaning you have it, you broke the law, into a non per se violation, where there can be a defense. I was acting as a journalist. Oh, I didn't comply with the rules? I thought I did. And I've seen conversations where pedophiles also talk about this being getting the camel's nose inside the tent. Now, for my life and my character and my work to be used as a vehicle to make this argument, which requires her to accuse me of felonies which were not committed, was appalling to me.
And I want to play a clip of your wife from David's NPR report on that.
It doesn't take much for word to spread, even if it's incorrect, and somehow that becomes reality. We've heard him attacked on every front and called all sorts of things, from pedophile to homophobe to anything else, and he doesn't deserve it.
So you left the Times, Kurt, to go to a magazine, and you aren't there anymore. Are you in a fight for your career?
I hope not. You tell me. I mean, you know, the bottom line is I have no idea why I should be. I did nothing unethical. I did nothing wrong. I wrote a story that stands up, that saved kids' lives, that locked predators up, that changed national policy. I made a mistake. I forgot something in the most complex ethical situation you could imagine. And let's bear in mind the whole issue of the money. I believed, based on my reading of the Times ethics policies, that if you find yourself in a financial conflict, you undo it. Now, there's nothing in the policies that deal directly with this situation, but I tried to undo it.
David asked
the kid for the money back.
Uh-huh.
He gave it back.
Huh.
I asked for the wrong amount. That's what this whole story is about.
You asked for too little.
I forgot how much I sent him.
And so you asked for $2,000 back, and it was really $3,100, something like that?
It's some larger than $2,000.
So, more, David, do you think... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead and finish your answer.
It's more than I forgot the full amount, and I asked for a different amount. And, you know, again, no one ever thinks about the fact that it's completely irrational for someone to ask for some of the money back and not all of the money back.
So, David, how serious do you think the remaining journalistic issues are, and how much do you think the wider journalistic community, based on your reporting, thinks that Kurt did something very egregious here?
Well, there are a couple of things to untangle, one of which is you mentioned Debbie Nathan earlier, and you played that cut from Teresa Eichenwald. And Debbie Nathan's reports, both in Ceylon, even though Ceylon fully retracted her article.
They did.
And yes, they did.
Why did they retract her article?
Eichenwald and his lawyers challenged the veracity of her allegations, particularly about the viewing of images. And they said there should be no impression left that he broke any laws and no evidence that they have to suggest that he did.
There's one other thing.
They pulled that back.
The foundation of her argument was that a law we cited did not exist and that I admitted it did not exist. We sent them a copy of the law, which proves she was wrong.
So to continue, though, the key thing about Nathan is that she set the tone for particularly journalism, gossip, and gay rights blogs in terms of how Eichenwald would be perceived. Subsequently, she took the revelations in court proceedings in both Michigan and Tennessee about these payments, first for New York Magazine in March, and then subsequently this summer in Tennessee, she wrote a bit for Counterpunch, this left-of-center publication. And she used those to intimate that somehow that his motives were not what they appeared to be, and that somehow his interest in the subject was not as presented. I've got to say, in my reporting and looking over all of those filings in Michigan, testimony elsewhere, that I couldn't find anything to support her intimations, but that affected very much the tenor of coverage on media and gossip blogs, and it affected, I think, how other journalists have approached Eichenwald's story.
So, Kurt,
and there's also there's one other very, very important thing here, is that the story was misrepresented from the get-go. The very, very first thing that was written by an editor and publisher, in which they were describing a Times editor's note, an editor's note that was mostly accurate. The very first thing that was written said, Kurt Eichenwald gave a loan to a source. It wasn't a loan, and he wasn't a source. That rapidly became, I paid a source. I didn't pay a source. That, you know, there was one media critic who said, I paid a source, and I called him up and said, if you kissed a girl in June and she died in July, can I say you kissed a dead girl? But this argument has gotten nowhere. People are so captivated.
You gave a person a gift. He later became a source.
And I got the gift back, or I thought I did. And so, you know, when you have a circumstance, David's laid out all of the conflicts that existed here. All of them I disclosed. I got the kid his health. I got him his freedom. I got him a place to live. I disclosed all that. People think the real issue is money that I thought I got back? That I didn't give to him as a source, but I gave to him as a different purpose.
David?
The complicating thing is there are journalists who, having a greater sense of what actually transpired inside the Times and elsewhere, some folks argue that Eichenwald should have been more careful, particularly knowing of his condition about his memory, that if he's getting in an incredibly complicated situation to document what he was doing, and as he emotionally began to be hit particularly hard by what he was doing, to take better stock about whether he was capable to translate what had been personal into this professional report. Kurt obviously feels that the report that he came up with was sound, but the toll he took, you know, the emotional stake he had in this, by lights of some folks would argue, would compromise his standing to be the person to present that publicly.
Right. Now, but I will be very clear about this.
15 seconds, Kurt.
Okay, the Times editors were alerted by me to the significant emotional trauma I was suffering. They knew about what was going on in these circumstances. What they didn't know about was the money, because I forgot. But other than that, you know, I certainly should have stepped aside by the fall when I realized how much trouble I was in. But I went to the Times.
Kurt Eichenwald and NPR's David Folkenflik, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in a minute, what should we really fear about MRSA in the community, and what should we not? Stay with us.